the work that we've done and our optimism on Tesla, which is rooted in deep research on the company, is it's not a car company anymore. It's a bet on autonomy. It's an artificial intelligence company. You know, imagine this. It is a strength, unequivocal strength, that Elon is running multiple businesses because there are obvious synergies there, whether it's SpaceX, whether it's X, whether it's Tesla, and you can see those synergies in real time. And the second is, judge the guy by what he's done. I think I'd have concerns if headline CPI peaked above 8%. That was a real problem. A lot of people looked at what happened after COVID and said, well, this is not going to be inflationary. And the most of their argument was based on what happened after the 2008 financial crisis. They saw the hundreds of billions of dollars in QE. They saw a pretty tepid fiscal response in February of 2009. And they said, look, the Fed's balance sheet went from 800 billion to 4 trillion, and we didn't get inflation. And so if we get similar numbers, and it was actually a lot more this time if you combine both what happened with Congress and the Fed, if we get similar numbers, they thought, why would it be inflationary? And they used that as the basis to essentially perpetuate the transitory hoax. And that's what it was. It was a hoax, right? It was used to continue to delay what was needed to address.
What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the Macro Insights podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, James Fish, back in the house. And we're going to get into a lot of things, including the consumer, what's going on with the overall macro situation, interest rates, you name it. But first, I want to start off with inflation. We're recording this here on July 10th. You know, Jerome Powell just kind of went out and had his, you know, his Fed testimony. And he's saying that inflation, the signs are not there quite yet in order for him to pull back and, you know, turn the needle, pivot interest rates. The market has been calling for a pivot since last year, I think, at this point, James. So I want to get your viewpoint on inflation, like where you think we're at, you know, where the consumer is, all of that. So I'll leave it kind of broad. Do you think that we've completed and battled inflation to the point where, you know, a pivot is deserved or should be on the cards? Or do you think it's still sticky and here to stay?
Well, we'll start with an easy one, Brandon. Thanks for the opportunity to be on with you guys. And there's, I want to just back up to how we got to this moment. A lot of people looked at what happened after COVID and said, well, this is not going to be inflationary. And the most of their argument was based on what happened after the 2008 financial crisis. They saw the hundreds of billions of dollars in QE. They saw a pretty tepid fiscal response in February of 2009. And they said, look, the Fed's balance sheet went from 800 billion to 4 trillion, and we didn't get inflation. And so if we get similar numbers, and it was actually a lot more this time if you combine both what happened with Congress and the Fed, if we get similar numbers, they thought, why would it be inflationary? And they used that as the basis to essentially perpetuate the transitory hoax. And that's what it was. It was a hoax, right? It was used to continue to delay what was needed to address the high inflation. The big difference between what we did as a government after 2008 and what we did after COVID, comes by other names as well, but let's just call it COVID here, is the money that was spent went directly into the hands of the consumers. Think about the American Rescue Plan, which is really the mother of all misnomers, because when did it come out? It didn't come out in March of 2020. No, that was the CARES Act that was passed by the Senate unanimously and then signed by President Trump. The American Rescue Plan came out in April of 2021. It was signed into law. Well, what was there to rescue in April of 2021? 150 million Americans had immunity to this virus that turned out to be, quite honestly, a nothing burger. People were going back to work. Schools were reopening largely, unless you were in one of those unfortunate blue counties or blue states. Everything was back to normal. The invisible hand that Adam Smith pontificated about in 1776 was working its magic. We were rebounding in a really big way, in large part because of what Trump did in the last 3 to 4 months of that term to get everything back up and running. And so what does Biden do? Just as the patient, just as the economy is about to be released from the hospital, Biden says, sit back down. We're going to do 5 more rounds of morphine. What was that? That was the Paycheck Protection Program, more fiscal stimulus. That was stimulus checks for absolutely nothing. That was the federal unemployment benefits, Brandon, which worked out in the summer of 2020, that 2 out of 3 workers who were getting these generous benefits were actually making more, collecting unemployment, than they were working. It's not supposed to work that way. You're supposed to make less on unemployment because it's a bridge to get to the other side of that down and out situation to get back to work. And so the American Rescue Plan really was the ignition. Yes, there were supply side concerns. Yes, when you shut down the economy and reopening, certain sectors are going to be rebounding in price in a pretty material way. But what made this far more sustained was throwing fuel on the fire, giving people money that they didn't necessarily need to spend on things that they didn't necessarily really need. And then you create the system where, hold on a sec, inflation hits 5% in June of 2021. How does the Fed respond? Do they hike rates then off of zero? No. What about the next meeting? No. What about the September meeting? No. What about the, no. And so they end up hiking 9 months, nine full months after the first time we breach 5%, more than double the Fed's inflation target, because they fell hook, line, and sinker for this transitory nonsense. I mean, we were told for the longest time by Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen, when rates were zero, that when rates are that low, we have to be careful because we don't want to take rates to the point where we would have to reverse policy. They said we could always raise rates anytime. Ben Bernanke famously said we could raise rates in 20 minutes if the facts justified that move. Well, when rates hit 5%, inflation hit 5% in June of 2021, that was pretty obvious. And when it kept getting worse and worse and worse, when headline CPI peaked above 8%, that was a real problem. And so that's kind of the long story on how we got into this mess. We got some really good news on the inflation front in the second half of 2023. Not good news in absolute terms, but good news relative to the disaster that was the worst inflation in 40 years. And then just as that good news was becoming clear to the Fed, they, of course, prematurely declared victory, just like George W. Bush in the Iraq War, the big mission accomplished. And what do you know? We get three just nasty inflation prints, really awful, and that totally dents their confidence. You don't go from three bad inflation prints to three good ones and say everything's over. You have to get greater degree of conviction and confidence. That's what the Fed is working on right now. They've said that there's two ways we cut rates near term. The first is we get more confidence on the inflation front. That's a function of time. Even the best inflation number tomorrow, when we get the June CPI number, isn't going to just suddenly convince them that we've solved the inflation problem. They need to see this play out with time, because they saw time play out in the second half of last year and then quickly become undone. And the second, Brandon, was, in Powell's words, a rapid deterioration in the labor market. And no, that's not unemployment going from 3.6 to 4.1. Maybe that's something like 4.4, 4.5. And it has to be for demand reasons, not supply reasons. We continue to see job gains. No, not the best jobs. A lot of it part-time, a lot of it for foreign-born, a lot of that going to illegal migrants coming across the southern border. But the reality of the situation is, it's just not likely that we see a rapid deterioration in the labor market in the coming months, the kind that the Fed would need to see to justify an imminent rate cut. And so I think the Fed is pretty much on hold, and for their own sake, that's a good thing, on hold until after the election. They are deeply political people. How do you know this? Well, 97% of employees in the Federal Reserve System donate to the Democratic Party. For every 10 Democrat economists at the Fed, there is only one Republican. I'm sorry, it is a political institution. Can you imagine if it was the other way around, if 97% of donations went to Donald Trump and they said, well, we said, well, look, it's not political. It's just, no, it's political. Better to admit it. And I think that Powell and company, they don't want to be putting their thumb on the scale one way or the other. They don't want to tip the election in favor of Biden. They don't want to tip it in favor of Trump. They'd much rather just step back and say, look, it's a close call either way. We need more data to confirm that inflation has actually been defeated. And until then, we're going to be on hold. I think that means they're on hold at September. Obviously, this month in July, without saying, they're going to be on hold. We get a rate cut in December. But again, what happens with Trump policy in the second term if he wins? And I think he will. That may change the game entirely.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be an interesting next 4 years for sure, especially if Trump wins. I mean, I know he's, you know, Biden came out and said when Trump was in office, you know, why are you influencing the Fed when Jerome Powell tried to hike in 2019 and Trump was like, pull back the reins, basically. And then now Biden's doing the same thing here again in his terms, trying to kind of sway a little bit on that. But, you know, I want to take a little step back from, you know, what you said about you know, the overall consumer and like the labor market, how you're looking at that. Now, you talked about like the stimulus checks, the PPP loans, all those kind of things that came out. And it was a, you know, a big jolt to the consumer who obviously was going to spend it, right? I mean, that's just kind of the American habit. When you get in money, especially in money that's deflationary, you try to spend it. Like America is not really much of a savings economy. It's more of a consumer-based economy. Now, do you think that really hurt the workforce efficiency? Because, you know, we're seeing a big push back to getting into the office. You know, maybe labor's more expensive and maybe not as efficient. And that's coming with like, you know, not as many, you know, job growth gains, people kind of staying flat in a position and whatnot. And that's kind of almost in a sense, like stunting the growth of a lot of these companies, because you're not seeing, you know, a ton of growth in companies outside of, you know, maybe the big seven that are holding up the S&P. So I'll leave it at that. Do you think that that's kind of maybe partially an issue as to it's not necessarily like the full global thing? It's more at the micro level. It's more at the consumer and the person just kind of not working quite as hard because they got some free lunch.
Yeah, that was definitely a concern, Brandon, very early on in the pandemic, late 2020, early 2021. You're wondering a second, hold on. If you're making more money working at home, either not working or working from home, mainly not working with the unemployment benefits, then that's inflationary for two reasons. Because one, you're getting paid more than you otherwise would have working. And the second is you're not working. And so now the firms that need labor, that are desperate for labor, have to raise wages to get people off the sidelines. And so what we call the replacement rate, effectively for those wages associated with the unemployment benefit, had to go up. And oftentimes we saw those wages get directly passed down to the consumer in terms of higher price. Labor productivity has been tepid, largely unimpressive over the last 10 years. But I do think with the advent of general artificial intelligence, we're going to supercharge a productivity wave in the US, which will largely be disinflationary / deflationary. McKinsey just this week found that 30%, up to 30% of working hours will be replaced by the technologies enabled by generative artificial intelligence, the likes of which are in Anthropic's Claude, of course, OpenAI's ChatGPT model, the most recent of which for Omni, is just breathtaking. I mean, right now, while we're talking here, I can pull out this notebook and I can write down a sketch of a website. Here goes the video player. Here goes the email registration form. Here goes the sign-up link. And I can take a picture of that, Brandon. And within 30 seconds, it will write the code that can then be instantly deployed to create what was a sketch into a full functioning website. That's where we are today. And so when people talk about generative artificial intelligence being an issue of hype, I agree with them, but for the wrong reason. I think that this technology is massively underhyped. Look at where we were when ChatGPT-3 came out in November 2022. We all remember kind of where we were when that happened. Maybe the first time you played with it or I played with it, I'll never forget. It was just unbelievable. And look at how much progress we've made in less than 2 years since then. If you assume that AI, just for argument's sake, is capped, if the technological capabilities of this technology are capped right here, right now, Claude 3.5, ChatGPT-4 Omni, don't go any further in technological capacity and capability than where they are today, we will still fundamentally and profoundly transform the economy and technology. And so that's a very conservative assumption, right? You don't necessarily need more compute for that. You don't need more CapEx. You don't need more investment. You'll need to lay off some workers. You'll need to train some new folks. But imagine a world where we just deploy this technology over the next 5 to 10 years and imagine the repercussions of that. Imagine what can happen for companies who can both drive top line growth, which is to say they can use AI to increase revenue, and then drive bottom line by replacing labor, not necessarily firing people. We often think about AI is going to lead to mass layoffs. It will in certain industries, but it will also mean the consolidation and of time. And so if you look at 30% of working hours, so much of what I do in my own life has now been replaced by artificial intelligence. You know, we were going to hire a third analyst for Azoria, my new investment firm. We decided against it because we built some really interesting tools based on OpenAI's API for GPT-4. And so if we're seeing these effects now, look, it's going to take time. It's going to take time for this to pan out. It's not just going to happen overnight. But this is, as we know, the fastest adoption of a consumer technology product in history. 1 million users in less than a week is the fastest growing technology on human record. And so the issue of hype, disagree. It's underhyped, not overhyped. And just imagine, I drive a Tesla every single day. I live in rural Florida. Tesla FSD, unlike Waymo, is not geofenced. Waymo only works in those particular cities, be it Phoenix, be it San Francisco or LA. I'm driving this Tesla on roads that no other Tesla has ever been on, and it's navigating them flawlessly. And so what ChatGPT did in a week, and it transformed and had this, what we've now called a ChatGPT moment. I think we're going to use that term going forward to talk about technological paradigm shifts, that we are seeing a ChatGPT moment for autonomous driving. Tesla is on the cutting edge of that. And so you don't have to make many assumptions at all to see what the future might look like in 10 years. And that's why I'm really excited to be launching Azoria at this time, because we think about macro investing. I really define it as investing around large shifts in geopolitics, fiscal and monetary policy, and technology. I mean, what's more macro than completely transforming the workforce, completely transforming how we do business, how companies are started, how people train, how people move on? And so there probably couldn't be a more exciting time to be doing macro investing than right now.
Yeah, and I agree with you completely. And I think, you know, it is an interesting time, especially with like the development of AI and just technology in general, just kind of like the robotics industry. But, you know, that kind of like leads me to believe, right, there, it's always been kind of a hot button topic for the past, I think like 4 years, especially since COVID, was, you know, minimum wage, right? I mean, you talked about replacing a lot of workers. Walmart, I know, like had a robot cleaner at one point in time, but it freaked out the patrons, so they like got rid of it. But, you know, McDonald's is moving towards more of the cash, like not having cashiers and robots flipping burgers in the back. You know, I think that that's going to be a growing trend where basically like the minimum wage jobs almost will be no more because it's not really worth it, right? I mean, you can use humans for well more extraordinary tasks. And so I guess in a sense, do you think that that's where we're kind of going, where it's like the consumer almost needs like, you know, maybe like a higher education or something along those lines in order to kind of, I guess, blend in with this new and improved workforce where it's going to maybe have like a higher barrier to entry, but once you're in, you're in? If you don't know this already, I am Green Candle, also have the Macro Insights podcast. You might have found me from there. So I appreciate you tuning in on this new podcast, the Macro Insights channel. If you want to support Green Candle and get some sick merch, you could check out thehodlshop.com. They've got a perfect section of Green Candle merch. I've got the sweater on right now. I've even got the white hat. We got a sick white hoodie as well. They got all different kinds of colors, truckers. They've even got the nice little green candle on the back. So much cool stuff. So go ahead and check it out. All right. Enough for me. Back to the show.
It's such a good question. And I think about it because I was at McDonald's this morning getting coffee. And I don't know about you, but I don't like the kiosks. And so I just go directly to the cashier. I think that speaks a lot to this technology being underwhelming as it's been deployed for very low labor cost blue collar work, especially in retail. I actually think that those types of jobs are far less vulnerable to AI than a paralegal or a above average lawyer or a data scientist, or dare I say an analyst at an investment bank or a hedge fund. I mean, I've got ChatGPT open right now. I can ask it questions about what the Fed did or what a Fed statement looked like. It can pull data in and run back tests on what a currency performed around the 2020 or the 2016 election. And so what normally would have taken $80,000 a year for a data scientist and could have taken several hours for them to do, not out of incompetence, but simply out of sheer time and allocation of resources, can literally take 3 minutes and cost $20 a month. And so I actually think what's going to end up happening is the jobs that are going to be affected are things like copywriting. data analysis, legal work, legal research, social media management. And so it's actually, of all ironies, it's the people who are going to college and getting that traditional four-year degree who would have worked at McKinsey or Deloitte or KPMG or Goldman Sachs or Sullivan and Cromwell, wherever the case may be, that their jobs, unless you're the 90th percentile lawyer or research analyst, you're in a pretty vulnerable space right now. And so what I tell young people as I travel my state for my nonprofit Incubate Debate is create a career path and an education that is insulated from the coming technological changes of AI. What is that? Carpentering. It is medicine. It is, dare I say, using your hands. If you have to use your hands, yes, AI is coming with humanoid robots, but that may not be until 8 to 10 years from now. Whereas right here, right now, take it from someone who didn't hire a third analyst, who was prepared to do it and was doing interviews. We didn't do it because AI is already providing those benefits. And so I would actually say, not that there's anything wrong, of course, with a retail job, but those folks are actually much better protected today because the technology, the self-checkout, the kiosks have been pretty disappointing. And customers don't like them. They're slow, clumsy, and awkward. And I'll tell you, what's going to be much more dangerous is the personal injury law firm AI that instead of having 10 people man the phones can have that perfect voice that you see now in the voice model, the Omni model of GPT-4, picking up phones, calls, taking notes, no one knows it's a human, and then writing a memo to the lawyer on a scale from 1 to 10, how likely are we to win this case? Should we pick it up or not? I mean, that's insane. Can you imagine how much more business you can create top line and how much cost you can save bottom line? We are in for an incredible, incredible run up. Yes, in public markets. Yes, in stocks. But just imagine the small businesses, Brandon, who weren't able to compete, who are now going to be able to leverage a technology that's going to only cost them a couple hundred bucks a month, a couple weeks of training. They're going to do extraordinary things. And so yet again, ingenuity and growth and technological innovation is being born right here in America at a time where European capitalism, which is really socialism, is failing, when the Middle East is falling apart, when Asia is just stuck in this low growth rut. It just shows that despite the failures of regulatory policy and Bidenomics in particular, that America continues to punch above its weight because we dare to think outside of the box. And so it's a really exciting time to, yes, be an investor, but also to be a business owner, because I can get to see other business owners take use of this technology and make something special out of it.
Yeah, that's all great points. And it leads me to think, right? I mean, so we've also seen, you know, the inflation is transitory, that kind of narrative. Obviously, that's not going away. But do you think like the embracing of AI is going to be almost like, in a sense, a way to help drive efficiency and I guess like help us get to the point where we're more efficient and just an overall better and stronger economy? Because we did see, you know, 60% of the money supply being print since 2020. You know, we're feeling the after effects of that. Is that the way we get out of it? Is essentially just embracing AI, having all the small businesses get AI and the larger businesses as well? Because I mean, small businesses got crushed. And if you look at the numbers, it's like 50% of the U.S. jobs are from small businesses. So, you know, my parents are small business owners. So that's near a subject that's near and dear to my heart. So, you know, I'm always all for that and, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit. And I've gotten kind of the feeling that just in general, that has been kind of almost in a sense killed here in the U.S., where the American dream used to be own your business, the white picket fence, own a house and everything like that. And now there's worries that, you know, maybe housing affordability is out of reach. Owning your own business is just, you know, too expensive to get off the ground. But do you see AI as essentially the beacon of light here where we can kind of like, once you embrace that and you know how to utilize that for whatever business you're in, that's how you'll be able to lower that bottom line and in a sense, you know, be able to get business off the ground?
I think so. I really do. And it's a skill that we should be teaching young people to know about and to then be able to leverage. Remember that 2008 film, Marley and Me? It's 2024 and it's AI and Me. How can we use AI? This is something that young people need to be thinking about and using in the classroom. When school districts ban the use of ChatGPT, they're shooting themselves in the foot because it's these students who are going to need to be comfortable with this technology and use it. Look, the reality is you're building something great, Brandon. You're building this new community, this new business, this new, really, it's a movement. And I got to tell you, as a fellow business owner, we often don't get paid for originality. We just don't. We get paid for delivering for results. And so much of what I write and what I research comes from in a process using AI tools. And I don't beat myself up over it, because that letter, that research piece, that note would have otherwise not gotten done had I not used this technology. And so I tend to gear our team toward outcomes-based workflow model, which is, it doesn't really matter how you got there as long as you're proud of the outcome. We need to be teaching the next generation of young Americans that that's what matters as well. And how you can expedite those outcomes is really through this new technology with AI. And I mean, think about it. This idea of programming language, whether it was C++ or Python, it was this cryptic Sanskrit type of way to talk to machines, that you could only really drive the efficiency gains of technology if you knew the secret code. No longer the case. If you're a 14-year-old girl in Baltimore or a 16-year-old in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, you can talk to artificial intelligence just as you would to your mom or dad or your friend, and get it to do things that would have not been possible 2 years ago unless you knew the complexities of C++ or Python. And so it's a really exciting time, I think, for young people in this country. And to embrace free markets, to embrace entrepreneurship, that Robert Frost quote, which is, you know, I took the road less traveled and it made all the difference. The way that young people were successful in this country, so the rule book said, was go to college, pay down your debt, put in your years at a big firm, and then maybe start something new. Not the case anymore. I think there's never been a better time to be an entrepreneur in America. And you can have a team of two people, three people, work as if you have 25 or 30 by deploying the technologies that are available today. Again, that assumption about ChatGPT-4, assume that we never get incrementally smarter than what's available on the market today. That is still a very powerful, powerful technological advance. And so, yes, look at the facts, look at what's available, and leverage it to the hilt, because that's how we actually continue to innovate as a country.
Yeah, and I love all that, man. And it makes me a little bit more hopeful, because, you know, there is obviously a lot of negativity when it comes to, you know, the inflation rate, kind of what is going on in the current market. So, you know, we've alluded to it a little bit today. The episode is going to come out after CPI. So maybe we look stupid. Maybe we look like geniuses after this. But CPI print for the month of June is coming out tomorrow. Consensus is about at 3.1% right now. And, you know, obviously Powell has come out and said that the signs aren't there for them to lower interest rates. Now, you alluded to it earlier in the conversation, how, you know, it's seemingly Powell lowered interest or started raising interest rates, a little late, right? I mean, obviously it was really delayed. And I have the theory here that they're going to do the same thing, but on the other side of things, they're essentially going to start cutting a little bit too late. Now, it because it's human error and backwards looking data. And I think that is kind of the issue that's afoot here, is that we're going to be looking at this data July 11th of June. So almost 2 weeks into the next month, you're not going to really see the true effects of rate cuts or rate hikes until a few months down the line. And so, you know, whether inflation is caught or whatever, at that time when they start pulling back is when they're going to already start to see some blood in the streets. And then it's going to be too late. Now, hopefully I'm wrong and, you know, the powers that be are really correct. But, you know, in a sense, do you think that that's almost a flaw in a sense as to looking at this macro environment? Because we're relying on humans to make these big overarching decisions, and humans by nature have, you know, a human issue and, you know, can have some human error. So, like, I guess the end around question here is, you know, how do we get out of this? And, you know, do you have faith that Powell is, you know, in a sense doing the right job in order to help us get out of, you know, this said inflationary time? What's up, everybody? It's your boy, Brandon, the brains behind Green Candle. Thanks for checking in this new channel I've got here at the Macro Insights Podcast. You can help support me and check out new content that I'm bringing out in short form on different social media channels at Green Candle IT on X, on Instagram, and on TikTok. So be sure to check me out there. And if you want to follow me personally, you can. I got it all on X at BKeys1010 and at Instagram at keys_doors. So go ahead and support your boy. All right, enough for me. Back to the show.
Powell has made four distinct inflation mistakes since the pandemic, the first of which was falling for the transitory hoax, full hook, line, and sinker, the most recent of which was declaring mission accomplished at the December Fed meeting, saying that because we had a couple of good inflation prints and we were looking like we're heading back to 2%, that all of a sudden we're going to cut three times. And the market, of course, never just takes it as three. They went and said, we're going to go six or seven. Remember that the two-year Treasury yield got as low as 4.1% in January, which at one point in the market was pricing seven rate cuts in 2024. Now the Fed is saying, we'll maybe do one. And so what I would say is use that as a framework. The markets have been remarkably resilient if you're one of those doom and gloomers who says, well, there's seven rate cuts priced, and if the Fed doesn't deliver those, the market's headed for a 10 to 15% correction. And yet here we are. In January, the market was saying the Fed needs to cut seven times. The Fed is going to cut seven times. And look at where we are now. The market's saying that the Fed's only going to cut once or twice this year, and the market's up 16% year to date. The NASDAQ, of course, up a heck of a lot more. And so it just kind of draws the question, what is the actual link between what the Fed is doing or expected to do and what stocks are doing and expected to do? We get all this hype about, well, how are stocks going to respond to this Fed meeting, or what's going to happen after CPI? And admittedly, stocks can go down 2 to 3% after a Fed meeting or after a bad CPI print. But as a macro trader, I can tell you that beyond just the 72 hours around a data print, there's really no relationship between what stocks do and what the Fed does, or and vice versa. And think about it this way. If I would have told you in March of 2022, when the Fed was sitting pretty at 0%, just about to hike 9 months late, if I would have said the Fed's going to go from 0 to 5.25 in less than 2 years at the fastest pace since a guy named Paul Volcker, and unemployment's going to be down, GDP is going to be up bigly still, by the way. If you strip out some of those volatile components in the first quarter, you get something that looks a lot closer to the fourth quarter of last year, which is still pretty impressive. And inflation is still going to be above 3%. That would have been really hard to fathom, right? What you would think that rates going from 0 to 5.25, unemployment would be maybe 5, 5.5. You would see a much weaker aggregate demand picture in GDP. And certainly not stocks up 30, 35%. And yet here we are, right? And so I think that speaks to the fact that the market is doing well, not because of the Fed, not because of any prospect of rate hikes or rate cuts rather, but despite that. And we have a really strong showing. I mean, look, NVIDIA is performing at a rate that is just exceptional. We're up 150% year to date in NVIDIA. That is remarkable. And yet rates are at 5.25. And 3 years ago, people were telling you, including some pretty sophisticated investors, were saying that tech stocks like NVIDIA and Meta and Microsoft can never do well if rates were to go above 2.5. And so the moral of this story, Brandon, is that the real economy and the Fed have a lot less to do with one another than the short-termism in the markets, this codependency, this obsession with Powell said moderately as opposed to modestly, and he's wearing a purple tie as opposed to a green tie. That is, I know it captures the attention of the FinTwit community on X and maybe some of our financial commentators, but the reality of the situation is that companies like Microsoft, which were long here at Azoria, invested in companies like Tesla and NVIDIA and Meta, that these companies will continue to punch above their weight, irrespective of what the Fed does. And so the Fed, to tell you the truth, is a sideshow. If you are focused on the stock market, if you are like I am, a macro trader who's focused on actually trading the Fed outcomes, then yes, what the Fed said and does and did and so on, that matters to trading. Well, are they going to hike in September? Are they going to hike in December? What is the terminal rate? Yada, yada, yada. But for the most part, the Fed is a sideshow. We need to stop talking about it so much. Focus on the actual fundamentals of companies, both good, bad, and ugly. I'll tell you, when the Fed was at the December meeting and they said that rates are going to go maybe we're going to cut three times, they said, because inflation's done so well. You had these garbage, I mean, garbage stocks like ChargePoint. ChargePoint, which has gone from 10 to 2 and now is 160, 170. And by the way, totally been replaced by every car manufacturer in America, every OEM going to Tesla and groveling and saying, we want the North American charging center. By the way, that was hard for the Tesla bears to even imagine 3 or 4 years ago. When you have companies like ChargePoint going up 60% in just a matter of days because the Fed says we're cutting, why would that ultimately help ChargePoint? Yes, I get the debt idea. Yeah, okay, whatever. But these are a fundamentally broken business that is being structurally pushed out by the massive incumbent that is Tesla, welcoming all, whether it's Ford, whether it's Nissan, whether it's Mercedes, onto this supercharger network, which I use, and it's incredible. So why is that company doing well? Because the Fed's saying, well, we might not, we might only cut three times. We might do this, that, and the other. And so I think there's interesting insights to be made. I think the biggest, and I'll leave it at this point, is, and this is a general investing takeaway that I've learned the hard way, is if you don't know why a stock is going up, you got to have an honest conversation with yourself. ChargePoint's fundamentals did not increase in a way to justify a 60, 70% appreciation in the stock because the Fed said we might do three rate cuts in 2024. That is called addiction. That is called a stock trading far and away from fair value because of some short-termism hopium based on what the Fed ended up not delivering, by the way. And so that's, I think, the moral of the story. I'm a high school debate kid at heart, did it for 4 years, was a national champion. I use these skills every day. And one thing high school debate taught me more than anything was question every assumption. Question everything. Be a radical free thinker. Just because the world says this works this way, you have to actually do your own homework. And oftentimes you'll find that because the world thinks that when rate hikes go from, you know, 0% on Fed funds up to 5.25%, that unemployment's supposed to go up and the economy's supposed to fall out of bed. Actually, if you did the math and looked at the way the consumer and business was positioned in this country, which is to say they were predisposed positively to higher rates because balance sheets in America, the largest corporate balance sheets and most household balance sheets, are fixed liability and floating asset. A lot of consumers, my mom and dad in particular, are benefiting from higher rates. And so if you've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, Brandon, you know, we talk a lot about the hoopla of 7 and 8% mortgage rates. Here's the truth. The average American is not paying 8% on a mortgage, not paying 7, not paying 5, not paying 4. They're paying 3.7. It's called a 30-year fixed rate mortgage for that reason. And the benefit of insulating and locking in that rate was further compounded by the fact that we had record home buying in 2020 and 2021, record refinancings in that period as well, that took advantage of low rates and locked them in. If the Fed takes rates to 15% tomorrow, you're still paying 3.7% on a mortgage. But guess what? The $200,000 you've got sitting in a money market mutual fund, which used to be earning 0% for much of the past 10, 15 years, is now clipping a pretty 5.25%. And so there's actually this dynamic that's in play right now that higher rates aren't just not affecting the economy, not just not slowing growth, but are actually in a non-trivial way, Brandon, supporting the consumer by distributing massive income through retail money market funds, through certificates of deposits, while at the same time, households are largely locked into these low mortgage rates that were secured in the wake of the pandemic.
Now, I can see the high school debate in here, man. You got the hands going too. You got it all, dude. But
we got the whole, like, my mom's Colombian too. So between the high school debate and my mom, you know, throwing up her hands every 5 seconds, I was pretty well ingrained on that front.
Yeah, but it's good. You're very well spoken because of it. So I think it's helped you out in the long run. So, but you know, you were talking a lot about, you know, tech stocks and kind of how they've been reacting, right? Because mm-hmm. It's usually under the assumption that risk on assets do well under low interest rate environments. But it's been very interesting, right? You brought up NVIDIA. NVIDIA has passed as like the number one stock in, you know, in the S&P 500. It's passed Apple. It's done all of this. It's had a ripping and roaring year. And if you ask, you know, all the traditional guys, it's it can't really be explained with any of the metrics, right? So there is some delusion in the market now. Is that something that worries you because of this delusion that we see, that, you know, everybody's hanging on every word that Jerome Powell says? It's, you know, dependent on whatever bird metaphor you're going to use. Is he hawkish? Is he dovish? Pigeonish? I don't even know. Like, is it something along those lines? Like, where Jerome Powell, as Kanye said, it has all this power, just like, you know, one man has it, and he can kind of move the market just based on a simple tone. So is that something that worries you, where we're seeing just, you know, so much money being dumped in, retail kind of FOMOing in up and down, and the volatility, it could potentially lead to something negative? Or is that something that's a positive and you just have to kind of figure out your way how to play around with it?
I think you have to reject simplistic thinking in all forms, right? When GameStop was going up 100, 200, 300% in January, February of 2021, that is very different from NVIDIA going up 100, 200, 300%, right? Just because some line on a chart is going parabolic doesn't necessarily mean that's a bubble worth shorting or a bubble at all. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's some speculative asset that's being driven by liquidity or whatnot. Let's just speak the truth for just a moment. What was revenue in the full year 2021 for NVIDIA? It was $16 billion. What was revenue last year for NVIDIA? $60 billion. What is revenue this year for NVIDIA likely to be? $80 to $90 billion. So revenue's going up 5, 6, 7 times. Yes, of course, the stock is going to outpace that a bit. But the reality of the situation is NVIDIA is creating the tools that is going to be used for this largest technological wave, not even just since the internet. It's bigger than the internet. It is bigger than the internet. And I'll tell you, I think that that actually works to our advantage at Azoria, because we reject simplistic thinking. We just don't say, okay, because a stock like NVIDIA is up 170%, that we're going to not buy it, or even worse, short it. No, we're going to look at it and say, look, what are revenue expectations over the next several years? What does profit growth look like? What are the adoption rates? What does the CapEx spend look like for artificial intelligence and the GPUs that are required here? And NVIDIA can continue to do well. I think also at the same time, and we've been long, is how can you pivot from stocks that have done particularly well, like NVIDIA, into ones that have not, like Tesla? I mean, Tesla was down at 1.40%. And that was at a time where version 12 of full self-driving was out, was the most powerful vision-only full self-driving program available. And it's not just available. I mean, we're talking about it's 5 to 10 years ahead of anything that's out there right now. And the stock is down 30 or 40%. It's a rare situation, Brandon, where you get the divergence the other way around. The stock keeps selling off because Elon tweeted this, or because that they thought that the shareholder vote was going to fail. But in fact, what's happening is the fundamentals of the company are stronger than ever. This is not a car company. I can't say this enough when I'm talking to people at the other end of the table who don't share the work that we've done and our optimism on Tesla, which is rooted in deep research on the company, is it's not a car company anymore. It's a bet on autonomy. It's an artificial intelligence company. You know, imagine this. The iPhone is launched January 2007 at the Moscone West Center by a man named Steve Jobs, really the greatest salesman of all time. And can you imagine saying you're not going to invest in Apple and saying, yeah, the iPhone might be big, but you're not going to invest in Apple because they didn't sell enough iPod minis last quarter? That's what you're talking about when these people say things like, well, FSD, yada, 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 shmada, shmada, shmada. No, it's because Tesla's deliveries in China underwhelmed last quarter, were below consensus. The reality is we will not be talking about Tesla physical delivery numbers 3 years from now in the same way we weren't talking about iPod mini sales 3 years after the iPhone came out. The core driver of Tesla's fundamentals, and in turn, the valuation of the company, is based on artificial intelligence. And so rejecting simplistic thinking is this old world idea of what were car deliveries last year and how do they compare quarter on quarter with BYD and so on. By the way, they're actually very impressive. I mean, this is the best-selling car in the world. The best-selling pure electric vehicle in the world is the Model Y. And so that's separate and apart from it. But this is an artificial intelligence company. The old world, broken, simplistic metrics of saying, well, the Model S and the Model X and the Model 3 and how did it sell? Irrelevant. The Robotaxi event is coming August 8th. Version 12.4 is out. I use it every single day on roads that weren't paved maybe until 10, 15 years ago. This thing is a killer. And we're looking almost at 2 billion miles at this point, Brandon. 2 billion miles driven on Tesla's full self-driving in incremental versions that have just gotten better and better. This is a breathtaking technology. It is a ChatGPT moment in slow motion. I am not one to admit to breaking the law, but if trading on material non-public information means you are guilty, then I guess sign me up. Because here's the material non-public information that I'm trading on. I get in that car and I drive 50, 60, 70 miles every single day. And I see what the shorts don't see. I see a technology that is working like magic, that is getting better and better every single release from 11.7 to 12.1 to 12.4 and so on. And if you're invested in the stock, if you're short the stock and you're not using FSD regularly, you are at a tremendous asymmetric information disadvantage because you don't really understand that the product that will drive Tesla's growth for the next 10 to 15 years. And so I'll always love the story when Stan Druckenmiller had an analyst come in and said, the analyst said, we should short Tesla. And he said, well, have you been in the car? And he said, no. And he had all the DCF, he had the analysis, he had a 50-page deck, and he fired the analyst right on the spot. That is the way. The way, and when I talk to Tesla short sellers, and I say, well, when was the last time you were in the car using full self-driving? Oh, I've never been in the car. I've never used it. Give me a break. Follow the facts. Follow the technology. Can you imagine, I go back to the iPhone reference. Can you imagine having access to the iPhone for 2 years and not using it, and then building a short case around the iPhone being a sucky phone, and then saying, well, I've never used the iPhone. I don't actually know, right? I mean, that's ridiculous. This is a real technology. It is unbelievable. It is incredible. It will change the world. And Tesla, by far, not even close, is the best way to buy real world AI in the markets today. It is the most undervalued artificial intelligence play. And that's why it's one of our top holdings at Azoria.
Well, I gotta put you on the spot here with Elon. Obviously, he's a polarizing CEO. Recent acquisition of Twitter. Now he's changed it to X. Now, how much weight do you put into that? Where Elon might not be, you know, putting his 100% full fledged effort into Tesla. Do you think because of how far along it is that doesn't matter, or does that play into your thesis with it at all, or is it I guess maybe a little bit overblown?
I think it's totally overblown. I judge Elon not by his tweets, although I find them hilarious. And I think he's done the Lord's work by creating this free marketplace of ideas on X. We didn't have that, by the way, in 2020 and 2021 when Twitter was run by Yoel Roth and effectively the FBI, right? You couldn't say certain things about masks. They rigged the COVID debate. If you were a parent complaining about schools being shut, you were shut out of the conversation. Imagine what this country would have looked like if we would have had real open debate on X and on social media platforms. My Vivek's a friend and he has this great quote, which is the path to truth runs through open debate. And what we now have with Elon and X is real open debate. May not be pretty always, it's gonna be messy, but it's the best platform to find truth and I love using it. What I would say is it is a strength, unequivocal strength that Elon is running multiple businesses because there are obvious synergies there, whether it's SpaceX, whether it's X, whether it's Tesla, and you can see those synergies in real time. And the second is judge the guy by what he's done. I think I'd have concerns if version 12.4 of FSD wasn't as extraordinarily impressive as it is right now. I'd be like, well, what are you doing, tweeting all day? But the guy's allowed to have a life. And he's allowed to have a life where SpaceX is just blowing it out of the water. Tesla's doing incredible things. X is making free speech and debate great again in this country. And so, yeah, I think that to the extent that people have some emotional concerns and think that he's distracted, that's that same short-term simplistic thinking that leads people to trade around Fed meetings, around stocks going up too much or down too much. And so I cut through that noise. I focus on the actual fundamentals of this company, and they have never been stronger, and they have never been more underappreciated and misunderstood by investors. And anytime you get that kind of asymmetry between what most investors think and what your research and your insight is driving you to, that makes a tremendous market investment opportunity.
Hey, I like that, man. And I agree with you too. I think, like, you know, people overblow it that, you know, people have other interests outside of just their company. You know, I mean, it's kind of, I don't know, ridiculous. As long as the company is still doing everything and, you know, shit's not hitting the fan, I say go for it. And I mean, Elon's just a high operator. So I agree with you 100%. But, you know, there's always been a question in the debate, you know, before with the interest rate environment. And I want to get you one last question here. Now, with everything going on, do you think that we're either currently in a recession, we're going to hit one, or we're going to hit a global depression? Because it seems like there's essentially no in between when it comes to FinTwit, and it's either doom and gloom, and it's going to come. It's just a matter of when. Do you think that that's going to be the case, or do you think we'll see some stagflation for a while and we'll kind of crab walk our way out of it?
You know, I didn't expect to bring up my former boss's name on this call, but I have my disagreements with him. But he said something hilarious last year, which was the White House tells you they don't know what a recession is, and they also don't know what a woman is. And so I think the definition, Brandon, of a recession, it just depends on what you're looking at. I mean, you look at the country right now, 8.5 million people are working multiple jobs. Inflation in many cases is 20, 30, 40% higher in this country. There's deep, deep dissatisfaction and disaffection with how this economy is working, which is to say it's not working. Bidenomics has been a complete failure. I think what we've had actually is this K-shaped recovery slash reception. You think about a K, right? The one line is the folks who own stocks and bonds and have a lot of excess cash that's now paying 5, 6% on their money, locked into mortgage rates. They're doing pretty well, let's be honest. But that bottom K, working class America, people who live in steel towns that have been rooted out, people who live in Appalachia who have been rooted out, who are seeing cheap fentanyl come across the southern border. You have half of working age men, Brandon, who are not working, are taking painkillers, opioid painkillers every single day. And so I would reject respectfully the idea of the binary between are we in a recession, are we not? For tens of millions of Americans, we are in a deep, deep recession, one that is being exacerbated by the Biden inflation, by the Biden crime crisis, and by the open border that is replacing their labor in very, very quick fashion. And so I think that the bigger takeaway here is this is why President Trump's message is resonating, not just with the traditional Republican base, but with voters in the South Bronx, in Philadelphia. I mean, these are places that no Republican has stepped foot on in decades. And you've got thousands of people showing up in the South Bronx chanting Donald Trump's name. It's because he believes more than anything in common sense. And so recession, yes and no. Yes, for those who are suffering under the crippling policies of this administration or suffering from inflation, who have seen what happens when you sell your country out to China and to big business, as opposed to focusing on fair trade, not the reckless free trade that ends up selling all of our IP to companies in Xinjiang or in Beijing. And so the K-shaped schematic is how I really think about it. And I live in a rural part of Florida, and I see the damage that these policies have done. We got a great governor here, but you really need leadership at the top. And so the K-shaped recovery is really the basis for the discontent and the disillusionment in President Biden. And that's why this sets up for really a record landslide for President Trump, the likes of which we haven't seen since 1980 between Reagan and a guy named Jimmy Carter.
That's awesome. James, you've been very generous with your time. So I really appreciate you coming in and sharing your great insights here at the Macro Insights Podcast. Why don't you tell people where they could find you and find out more about your fund, Azoria?
Absolutely. So I'll give a quick plug for Azoria. Azoria is a investment firm that believes in three things: meritocracy, excellence, and radical free thinking. And I think I've summed up the gist of that, not by telling you about it, by showing you how we walk through these ideas, how we think about what the markets say or what people believe versus what we actually research gets us to. And, you know, we had this idea going into when I left Greenlight, scary word, when I left Greenlight, this idea of, you know, just launching a traditional hedge fund for people who could invest $2, $5, $10 million. But I've gotten the chance to talk to a lot of people over the last 2 months, and I've come to the conclusion that we're putting the private hedge fund for the millionaires and billionaires on hold. We're going to do that in the second half of next year. What we are pouring all of our resources and attention to is launching an exchange traded fund that allows anyone in the country, whether you're a firefighter in Coeur d'Alene or a nurse in Cincinnati, gives you an uncorrelated return stream. We talk about investing in stocks and bonds, but what about investing in an investment fund that is focused on the big picture shifts in technology, geopolitics, and monetary and fiscal policy? The biggest macro trades that we've talked about, Brandon: inflation, the Fed, oil, copper, AI. A lot of those trades are not going to be available to everyday Americans, everyday investors. And so this investment fund, combining our research, our background, and thinking about how we put on these trades and how we structure our investments, that's what we're going to deliver in the Azoria Macro Fund, which is launching in the first half of next year. And I can't be more excited, because we're going to do it in a new way. We're actually going to have a monthly call, the first ever ETF to do this, a monthly call with our investors. So whether you own 1,000 shares of Azoria or 10,000 shares of Azoria, you're going to call in just like this. We'll have thousands of people on the call and ask us questions about how we think about the Fed, how we think about the upcoming election, or the oil markets, or inflation, or growth, and how we're positioned around these different realities. And so I'd like to think that our investors will benefit from hearing my insight, but I got to tell you the truth. I'm going to benefit just as much, if not more, from having people on the ground tell us what they're seeing and what they're thinking. We're going to incorporate those ideas and those perspectives in our investment products, and we're going to do something extraordinary with it. And so on X, James Fishback, J_Fishback is the handle. And funny enough, headofmacro.com is my free Substack, where I'll be soon sharing my macro thoughts and talking about what's to come.
That's awesome stuff. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the launch, man. Maybe we'll have to have you on shortly after everything is launching, but I'll put all that in the show notes. And James, yeah, man, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brandon. Have a great one.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Macro Insights Podcast, where I am bringing you the latest and greatest in the macros, traditional finance, stocks, real estate, all that, all these great guests, so you can be the most up-to-date on everything that's going on in the world. If you enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking for you, so you can click on this right here, and you can go to the next episode immediately. Or if you're looking for some more Bitcoin-related content, I've got a channel right for you. It's my other channel, Green Candle, so go ahead and click that. All right, and if you found value in this, smash that like button, hit that subscribe button, tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough for me. See you at the next one.